Welcome to In the Elements.
Smith.
And I'm Becky DePodwin. Welcome to In the Elements, where we explain science through the human lens.
Today we're talking about the devastating Gatlinburg wildfires that occurred a year ago this November.
We talked with Kevin Wagner, who works in emergency management, and he helped shed some light on this particular situation.
Dr. Cristino Marer also stopped by to discuss the ecology of these events and how we can better prepare ourselves.
And finally, we were lucky enough to be joined by Tessa Nauman, who actually had to flee the fires.
But before that, let's talk about what happened. Becky, this fire took a fair amount of people off guard. It spread quickly in a relatively highly populated area. What were some of the meteorological precursors to this event?
So just some facts and a weather setup of the day of the Gatlinburg fire. The area, much of southeast United States, and especially in eastern Tennessee, was under what's called exceptional drought conditions. This is the highest the scale goes on the U.S. drought monitor. Most of the southeast had been experiencing these extremely dry conditions for over 2 months. The fire occurred toward the end of autumn, when deciduous trees had lost all of their leaves, and they'd all fallen to the forest floor. This meant there was a plethora of dead leaves, branches, twigs, all dried out by the sun in the last few months of rainless weather. In the days leading up to the fire, it was extremely dry. Relative humidity values were around 20 to 30%, which was very low for that part of the country. The forecast for that Sunday morning mentioned wind gusts of 30 to 40 miles per hour by that evening. At this time, the fire was still south of Gatlinburg. Heading into Monday morning, the National Weather Service at Morristown issued an urgent weather message for areas including the Sevier County portion of the Smoky Mountains in Gatlinburg. A high wind warning in effect from 1 p.m. this afternoon until 7 a.m. Tuesday. A high wind warning means a hazardous wind event is expected or occurring. This means there can be sustained winds of at least 40 miles per hour and gusts of up to 58 miles per hour or stronger. Property damage and power outages were also possible. As the wind intensified, they spread burning embers and flames into the city. The Gatlinburg Fire Chief Greg Miller said around the time of 6 p.m., the wind speeds doubled. There were times we had wind gusts in excess of 87 miles per hour. That's hurricane force winds. According to Miller, that is nowhere to be when trying to fight a fire. Those winds of that nature, it's common to pick up embers of a fire and take them greater than a mile away. This means the fire spread very, very easily.
This sounds like a perfect storm for a wildfire to spread. How good was this forecast?
So it's kind of a tough question. I spoke with a meteorologist at the National Weather Service Morristown who wanted to remain anonymous due to the ongoing investigation even a year later. The warnings themselves, from what I understand, were good. They were just maybe a little bit late and a little bit underdone. I don't think anybody anticipated winds of almost 90 miles per hour with this. And it seems like the winds picked up a little earlier than expected as well. Kind of one of those things that it truly was a perfect storm. All the conditions came together, drought conditions, high winds, you know, a wildfire already going on. And it just happened to spread extremely rapidly and out of control in a situation that no one could have really forecast or controlled.
Becky, you're a meteorologist by training. You're doing work right now in emergency management, getting your master's in that. Based on this forecast, was the response by the emergency management officials adequate?
So when this fire occurred, I was still in the very beginning stages of getting my master's. I've had a lot more time to kind of digest all of this, but I'd still like to defer to an expert. So we brought an expert onto the show and we spoke with Kevin Wagner, who is a volunteer firefighter and emergency manager. So we're going to dive a lot deeper into the emergency aspect of the Gatlinburg fire. Familiar with the Gatlinburg fire and everything that went down with that. Do you want to start just by giving like your overall opinion, like your take on what happened?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's a bad situation that just got worse. You know, it multiplied and got worse. These kinds of fires just, they create their own weather systems. And so if you don't have somebody there monitoring it on the ground, somebody who knows, it doesn't really you're not really getting the best intel as an emergency manager then on how to plan your next couple hours, your operational sectors. Unfortunately, the fire was started, you know, as an arson fire. So that's already strike one. You know, we have this new system of trying to get, you know, watches and warnings and trying to get messages to the public that rely on cell phones. But cell phone technology isn't as advanced in this case. You know, you only have about, I think it's like 90 characters to try to warn the public. And so you can't just warn them. You also have to be able to explain it. You can't just tell somebody to evacuate. You actually need to tell them why, or else that'll cause more panic. So you have that issue, and then compounded by, unfortunately, an erroneous forecast, or not necessarily erroneous, just incomplete. And then, you know, multiplying all those things together just makes for a really bad situation.
What are your thoughts on kind of just the overall forecast from the National Weather Service?
Trying to forecast winds, especially for such a hyper-local, I mean, you're talking about a square mile that you're trying to forecast for. You know, trying to pinpoint winds for that isn't the easiest thing in the world. The Gatlinburg fire chief reported that they had winds in excess of 87 miles an hour. It all has to do, I think, with the dynamics of what was going on. And unfortunately, at 87 miles an hour, you can put the best wildland firefighters out there and they're not going to be able to stop it. You know, you have the front line that kind of, you know, the main push of the fire. But with winds like that, you're sending embers, and with the dry land, it's just going to go like that. You know, you had spot fires pouring down off this mountain, and within about an hour, they said that they were getting reports of fires within the city. And so in an hour, you can't evacuate. I mean, you're still trying to formulate a message to send out to the public in an hour between when you get the forecast, the 87 mile an hour winds, and you get the first reports of fire within the city limits. You're not going to have time to send out an effective evacuation message. Here we are today. So, unfortunately.
So I guess that begs the question, did the city stand a chance? Was there any way this could have been handled differently that would have resulted in a less chaotic and devastating evacuation? Could this have been done differently if the forecast had called for winds of 80?
I mean, yeah, if certainly, you know, if the forecast called for winds in excess of 80 miles an hour, I'm sure that the planning for evacuation would have been a little different. But there's always going to be a push. You know, emergency managers are going to want to evacuate. And sometimes, and I don't know if that is the case in this situation, but sometimes city officials or municipal officials push back. We don't have the resources to be able to do that. You know, we don't want to cause a panic and that sort of thing. And so sometimes there's pushback about evacuating. You know, it's a back and forth. I don't know if they had a chance, if situations were going to be different, if they would have been able to, you know, effectively evacuate even half of the city limits in time. You know, at 87 miles an hour, it's just so fast. I don't think so.
In population centers, when a wildfire impacts a population center like this, do they have a plan ready to go beforehand for a situation like this?
Yeah. I mean, in the past, I would say two decades, the big push in emergency management has been for all hazards. So, you know, judging by that, I'm sure in this area, one of their, maybe not primary hazards, but a close second would be something along this line. So I imagine that there was a plan for, you know, the best laid plans for some sort of wildland fire. Now, you know, I doubt even when I've done planning, it's really hard to just think of every aspect of what goes in. Well, what if this happens? What if this happens? So I doubt when they were writing the plan, 87 miles an hour was built into that plan. That being said, though, I'm sure that at a certain point they followed a plan, speaking for myself, when I was, you know, working in emergency operations centers, taking that plan is just one small part of it. I mean, you're really just reacting to the situation around it, you know, big buzzword in emergency management is situational awareness. And so you're just really trying to, you know, get as much good intel as you can in, sending good information out. And if you're not getting good intel in, then you're not going to send good information, or in this case, any information out.
So who's part of the intel coming in? I'm assuming probably National Weather Service, but what other entities are collaborating during a crisis like this?
I'm sure in this case, the National Weather Service was going to be big. You have the Gatlinburg Fire Department. They'll probably have a representative in the Emergency Operations Center, maybe not the fire chief. He might be out, you know, monitoring wherever their command post is, but they'll have a liaison in the emergency management, the Emergency Operations Center. The Park Service will probably have a liaison both in the command post and possibly in the Emergency Operations Center as well. And really any agency that they utilize that can bring in information. I mean, even the news, even the media, you know, they send up the helicopters and you can see where the fire is. That is huge information that they can use to say, this is how far it's advancing. This is here are the neighborhoods it's impending on, and we need to get to them immediately.
So the WEAs are wireless emergency alerts. They're usually sent out for tornado warnings, flood warnings, amber alerts, evacuation notices. I mean, they're meant to pop up on your phone, get your attention immediately. They have an obnoxious sound, like you can't avoid it. And in the case of the Gatlinburg fire, these never went out to mobile phones. And apparently, according to John Matthews, who is the director of the Sevier County Emergency Management Agency, said that it was his understanding that the evacuation alert had been sent to mobile devices. However, it was, in fact, only broadcast on area TV and radio. And it didn't go out until 9:04 p.m., which was pretty much a couple of hours after flames had already started making their way into the city. And I know Kevin kind of mentioned this earlier, is there is the character limit. So it's great to say, hey, massive fire, evacuate, but you can't say anything else. You can't say where the fire is. You can't say where they should evacuate to. Like, you don't have room to say all of those things. So I guess my question for Kevin is, what is your opinion of WEAs in general? And do you think that the character limit needs to be extended for them to be at all effective?
That's an interesting question. I'm waiting on word from FEMA about their IPAWS, the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System. They're developing some sort of committee to discuss it and discuss how to improve it. And so hopefully we'll hear something from that committee sometime in May, which I hear is when they're first going to start meeting. My experience is WEAs aren't necessarily sent out. It's restricted how to send them out. It's not as simple as the old emergency broadcast system or the emergency alert system. There are a lot of third-party applications that can also send out information. Everbridge is one that is really popular. While they also have character limits, they're also customizable. They're also, physically type. You're not really necessarily restricted. It can go out to email or phones. So, I mean, there are a lot of options out there, and to solely rely on the WEAs, which it's a great technology, when it comes to like those amber alerts where you can send it out to multiple counties. They're great for sending out those mass messages that maybe aren't as critical to the people further away. But I don't know about relying solely on them for things like tornado warnings, flash flood warnings, or in this case, evacuation orders.
We were reading an article about how the fire pressure was lost during the city, so they couldn't even fight with water. They couldn't even, use water to try and fight the flames. There was a quote from an article that said, Phelps and city officials did not respond to questions about why the pumping stations didn't have auxiliary power supplies such as generators. Officials also ignored inquiries if generators will be installed in the future at the pumping stations. So power went out. They couldn't use water to fight the fire. They didn't have a backup plan, and they still apparently have no plans to create a redundancy. Any thoughts on that?
It might come down to budget, you know, unfortunately. You know, when I started in emergency management in 2009, there was still a lot of grant money out there, based on, you know, what happened in 2001, and after Katrina. And then we've slowly seen it kind of fall off. And there's still grant money out there, but a lot of smaller towns might rely on that kind of money for all of their emergency management and their preparedness. So, you know, it's unfortunate. So having a secondary option for a water supply may have been written in there, you know, and it may have been just using tankers from outside agencies that come in, or, you know, using those helicopter drops. But, you know, at a certain point, you're not going to be able, you know, you need a lot of water to fight these fires. So if you don't have your primary source readily available, you're going to have to rely a lot on secondary sources. And if they're not ready to go, then you're going to take, you know, 24, 36, 48 hours to get things moving.
So losing power to the pumping stations, is that something that happens frequently when, like, something kind of catastrophic happens to a city?
I hope not. You know, I don't really know how far the fire went, what kind of infrastructure it impinged on.
It sounded like it was just power, and then I think one of the pumping stations actually burnt down. So there was like a twofold thing there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing you can do about the fire taking over the actual pumping station. And then, you know, you couple that with loss of power. And so that you lose that pumping station, and then that all that other work has to go to those pumping stations, but the power isn't there to do it. So, you know, it's kind of like this offhand card that you're dealt, and you just have to, you know, you have to roll with it.
Fortunate enough to talk with Dr. Henry Grissino Mayer, a professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Tennessee. He's also the director of the Laboratory of Tree Ring Science at the University of Tennessee. I wanted to talk with him about the ecology of wildfires and how they happen naturally, but we got into a much deeper conversation about wildfire awareness and preparedness. Listen in. Okay, so what purpose do natural wildfires serve an ecosystem, and why are they important to an ecosystem?
Wildfires have been happening ever since there's been fuel to burn. And by fuel, I mean anything organic, such as trees and grasses and weeds, shrubs, you know, houses, you know, things like that. So wildfires have been happening for eons, millennia, in fact. And they're a natural part of our ecosystem, and I mean every ecosystem, from tropical rainforests all the way up to tundra. They serve a vital purpose. Wildfires, for one thing, wildfires recycle nutrients. In other words, rather than have all the nutrients tied up in debris on the forest floor or in the grasses, you know, we've got to regenerate. And one way to regenerate is to burn the forest, recycle nutrients. At the same time, wildfires will clear out a forest, make it much more open. The nutrients, of course, get recycled, and this actually benefits wildlife. So it's a natural part of the ecosystem. It's been happening ever since there's been things to burn, lightning being the primary cause, and of course, trees and plants have adapted to fire. And that's one thing, one of the most valuable lessons we've learned over the last 35 years is that fires are a part of the ecosystem, and they will continue to be a part of all ecosystems.
So another part of those ecosystems now are people. In late 2016, there was a pretty bad wildfire in Gatlinburg and Great Smoky National Park. So what kind of conditions led up to that? And from an environmental perspective, why was that wildfire so intense?
The new issue about wildfires being a, you know, natural part of all ecosystems. Unfortunately, people love areas that wildfire has been common in and has occurred in. People love to get back to nature. People, humans, like to live in communities where it's very rustic, it's mountainous, beautiful views. You're on slopes, you're overlooking creeks, you can see wildlife, you can see bears, you can see deer, you can see, you know, wolves in the western U.S. You know, people want to get back to nature. And so we tend to build in these beautiful areas. And in fact, here's a stunning figure for you. About 100 million people in the United States live in these types of areas, and these areas also are prone to burn, prone to wildfire. We see this every year. There's a fire going now in Brian Head Fire out west. Wildfires happening every year, and these wildfires will threaten these humans and human communities that have now established into these areas that are prone to wildfires. This is called the wildland-urban interface. And we tend to live there. We've got 100 million people now, all the way from California, Oregon, Washington, New Mexico, Arizona, all the way over here to the largest concentration of wildland-urban interface in the eastern United States. And that's a problem because these areas have burned in the past, and they will burn today, and they will burn in the future. So the question is, how can people learn to live with wildfire if they're going to build and live and work in these communities where wildfires should be happening? So we've been putting fires out for a long time, ever since the early 1900s, when a policy of fire suppression came about. It was kind of a misguided policy, what they did not know at the time, that all fires were bad. Fires had to be put out. Fire destroys the wood, which is a major part of the economy, the fabric of the United States. And so let's protect the wood. Let's put out all fires. And then, of course, we've got the Smokey Bear campaign started in the late 1930s, early 1940s, teaching people that only you can prevent forest fires, giving the message that basically fires are bad. It's been a major educational campaign, but one that we need to kind of adjust to the reality here, is that fires are, in fact, the new reality is a hashtag known as Good Fire, understanding that fires are part of the ecosystem. And if you live in these areas that were prone to wildfire, you need to learn about wildfire. You need to learn as much as you can about how to adapt yourself, your home, your property, your community to exist with wildfire. It's not going away. Wildfires are not going away. We will try to suppress it, and we may win a battle against wildfire. We may get it 80% contained. You see this all the time in the news, but we will never win the war against wildfire.
We need to be more aware. People who live in these areas need to be more aware. Was that the case in Gatlinburg? Could have there been more awareness that maybe could have prevented the kind of chaotic evening that took place?
Gatlinburg is a valuable lesson. In fact, everybody in Gatlinburg, not just in Gatlinburg, but all the agencies that were involved in fighting wildfire here in the Southeast and across the nation, local governments, state governments, federal governments. I mean, you would be surprised at how this Gatlinburg fire is kind of redefining about knowledge about wildfire, the need for knowledge about wildfire. People in Gatlinburg did not know that they were living in a wildland urban interface in an area in a mountainous environment, heavily wooded environment, beautiful villages in the mountain areas of Gatlinburg, did not know that this area has burned in the past, burned frequently in the past. In fact, National Park had fires occurring regularly up until it became a national park in 1934. And then after 1934, nothing. All fires are gone. So the people don't know this. The local administrators did not know this. The Park Service did know this because that's where we've done part of our research in the national park to inform them of how often wildfires occurred in the past, how big these fires were. And that helped alert them to the problem that they've got a lot of fuels that have built up over the past 80 plus years. And unfortunately, those fuels have to burn. They will burn. That's exactly what happened here. All you need is an ignition source, and that's what happened in Gatlinburg. Human-caused ignition, arson, and there are plenty of fuels. The fuels were extremely dry. The winds picked up November 27th and especially on November 28th, and all the right ingredients were there for a catastrophe. But the people did not know what they were living in. I've gone to Gatlinburg many times, of course, since then, and seen the evidence of fire, past fires, in the yards of the people that live in Gatlinburg, and the people were not aware of it. The politicians, the city council, the county commission did not know. The fire crews did not know. The in Gatlinburg, Pigeon Forge, Sevier County did not know. You know, they know of the danger of fire. They just had no idea that it was such a high level, a high risk of wildfire. And yeah, they were on alert, quite honestly. Yeah, they did know that fire could break out. They just had no idea that it would happen with such catastrophic force.
I wanted to talk maybe just for a moment about how wildfires might change and have changed. Is there any sort of expectation from research that says wildfire frequency, intensity, maybe even location might change as global temperatures rise?
Yeah. There have been numerous studies, I mean, so many studies over the past, you know, I'd say 20 years, examining the future fire risk, especially in the United States and Canada. A recent study just came out in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that pointed out that fires are going to become more frequent and more intense, more catastrophic in the future because of warming temperatures. Temperatures are increasing globally. As temperatures increase, that means the risk of fire increases too, because first off, it dries out any fuels that are there, any wood, anything that burns, lengthens the fire season as our winters become more mild. So we have longer fire seasons all across the United States. So the first thing that's going to increase or change is going to be warming temperatures. Number two, human populations are going to keep increasing in these fire-prone areas. Number three, wildfires will keep increasing because of all these conditions. And those three things you cannot change: climate, human populations, and wildfires. And that means that people have to learn to live with future wildfires. I go to these conferences, you know, I present, you know, I do this type of research. I present to other scientists, and we exchange ideas and results and everything. And we publish in peer-reviewed journals. Oh, yeah, that's what we do as professors and scientists, right? But we're not very good at getting this information to the public, to the people that need to hear it and learn from it.
I just, from a personal perspective, I've lived in Colorado now for 3 years, and I've never actually, besides like seeing a sign, I've never really been engaged or talked with anyone about wildfires out here.
Exactly. And yet here's the thing. Up at this meeting, I was up there. There are 25 people from across the U.S., and we all agreed that this country needs to do a better job of getting the message out to the people, you know, and there are programs that exist. Just like you said, you know, you need the National Fire Protection Association is going to be the forefront of this. They already are, but they need to get out there and let the people know that, for example, there's a program called Ready, Set, Go. They also administer the FireWise program. In other words, to educate people about what you can do right now to make your house, your property, your family safer from wildfires. Why do we spend $500 million or even more, billions of dollars every year fighting fires, when we can take that money and invest it in a preventive program to mitigate the potential for wildfires? That's amazing to me that we don't do that. Other countries do that, and we don't. It's like we would rather take the money and spend it fighting wildfires rather than preventing wildfires.
Before we get into the next story here, I want to talk about the woman who I talked to for this story. Her name is Maria Teresa Nauman, or Tessa Nauman, and I found her through Twitter, and I had a lovely conversation with her. We talked, it was probably like July of 2017, and this episode is not going to be published until November of 2017, and unfortunately, Tessa passed away in mid-August of 2017, and I really enjoyed my time talking with her, and it's really sad to get this news. I actually found out through Twitter. I searched her handle because I hadn't seen her tweet in a while. I wanted to share the episode with her, and unfortunately, I saw her friends and family on Twitter talk about her. This episode is dedicated to Tessa. She was a great storyteller. She was a freelance writer. She was a photographer. She had a lot of passion for music and arts. And she had a cat who's going to make an appearance in this episode. And she loved that cat. So we'd like to dedicate this episode to Tessa. Here's the story. As someone who is curious about all things weather, I really wanted to talk with someone who lived through the Gatlinburg fires, as furious and swift as they were. To me, making a personal connection and hearing the rawest form of the story filled with emotion makes a lasting impact. I'm hoping it's a story we can learn from. As I started to search for someone to talk to about these fires, I realized I don't know anyone in that area. So I set out to use humans' latest and greatest technology, the internet, specifically Twitter. On a Twitter application called TweetDeck, you can search for certain words in a certain area during a certain time. So I chose a radius around Gatlinburg from November 28th to November 30th of 2016, and there were tons of results. At first, it was tough to parse through bots into endless news outlets. But eventually, I found someone, a real-life human, tweeting about the event. I reached out to a dozen or so people. The only person that responded and wanted to talk was Tessa.
Hi, is this Dakota Smith on Twitter?
This is Dakota. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. This is Tessa N, or Tess N, on Twitter.
Tessa is a Gatlinburg native and a freelance writer.
The main street in Gatlinburg is called Parkway. And my neighborhood actually is just right off the parkway. That day, I noticed when I got up that day that it was, I looked out the window and it was very hazy, very smoggy. And we'd had days like that before because of the fires that were elsewhere in the state and also because of fires that were even out of state. The smoke was blowing in and as the day progressed, it turned from not just being like what you would consider like just sort of a normal hazy day. There started to be a tinge of like a strange red-orange kind of color to it. And that sort of rapidly became like the overwhelming color. It was very odd. You actually felt like you were in a movie of some sort. Never seen this kind of color before, and that's all you saw. The atmosphere was colored.
I have to drop some science here. The atmosphere turns this color not because of the flames itself, but because of the combination of the sun's light and the smoke. Light is made up of all colors, you may remember, Roy G. Biv, and each color is associated with a different wavelength of light. As sunlight passes through our atmosphere to Earth's surface and to your eyes, gas particles, mainly nitrogen and oxygen, can scatter it. Our atmosphere favors scattering wavelengths associated with the color blue, which are shorter in size from 400 to 500 nanometers. When you add smoke, however, more and longer wavelengths are scattered, thus more colors are scattered, like green and yellow. What color is left? The ones with the longest wavelengths, oranges and reds. Back to Tessa.
People were saying, you know, there was ash on their cars, and in some sections there was ash coming down, almost like you'd expect to see snowflakes, but it was ash. Today, there were no mountains. You didn't see anything, and the sun up in the sky was just this kind of light, whitish yellow spot, and surrounded all in this weird red orangish color.
The fires have yet to arrive in town, and it's already sounding like a scene from Mad Max.
Around 6:30 or 7, I had called again to the police department because things seemed to be getting sort of worse, atmospheric kind. The winds, really, the wind started about 5:30 here, and they were really whipping up. And that was my major concern at the time. And I had called the Gatlinburg Police Department again, probably an hour or two after I called them the first time. And while I was on the phone with them, the phones went out. And the cell phones had gone out. I had called them on a landline. And then in the middle of asking them again about evacuations, the landlines went down.
With her phone connection with the police station down, Tessa kept in contact with a neighbor of hers to see what her plan was.
I think about 8 that night, she called me and said, we had been calling back and forth, keeping in touch with each other. And at 8 that night, we were still able to call each other. And she called and said, I'm going to take off now. I can see a red glow coming across from the other neighborhood, coming like over the hill there, and it's red and glowing, and so I'm going to head out of town now. And she said, I think you should too.
Tessa not only had to evacuate herself, but also her 98-year-old grandmother.
You know, and I had called her and told her that she needed to pack a bag and to be ready because we may have to evacuate. So I called her again and told her to be ready. I'd be down in a little bit to get her.
Did I mention her cat?
I don't have a cat carrier. I have a cat, though. And so I got everything packed up, went around the house, got things that I needed, and packed the car. By this time, the power had gone out. So there was no power. And I went out into my garage and opened it manually. I had to get everything fixed because I knew the cat was the very last thing I could get out of the house. So I got the cat, who does not like to be picked up or held in any way. And I still have the scars as a memory of that day. The goal was just to get in the car and keep holding her. And so I left my house, and I left my house wide open. There was no power, so I couldn't close the garage door, and I was not getting out of the car, trying to already contain a wildcat in my hands. So I got in the car and took off, and the wind was so bad, it was just beating my car back and forth. It was sort of almost like being in a ride at the fair, and I thought, gosh, I'm probably going to die just trying to get out of my neighborhood. A property that used to belong to friends of mine, I could see that property was on fire in two places. The hill bank behind their house also had a horizontal line of fire, and I could tell that that fire was probably going to keep to the left and probably just follow along, which would bring it over into my neighborhood. Continued on down Hill Street. When I got to around that curve, I saw that there were two cars in front of me, and they were stopped. Then I got a little closer, and I saw that the drivers of both cars apparently had been out of their cars, and they were running back to their cars. And the car in front of me, the driver of it, saw me, and he ran up to me, and I recognized him as a neighbor and good friend of mine. And he said, there's and until he told me, I couldn't see it, but there was a tree down on the road, across the road, and that's why they had stopped. And but he and the other neighbor had worked to they were somehow able, by grabbing hold of some limbs and everything, they were able to move that tree just a smidgen, just enough so that if you went towards the tree and like made an immediate left turn to the left sharply and then turn back to the right sharply, you could just get under the tree. And so that's what they did, and that's what I did. And I could feel the tree scraping along the top of the car, still holding on to a struggling wildcat, and went down and pulled into my grandmother's driveway. And there was a policeman at the end of our street. And when he saw me pull into the driveway. He came roaring up and pulled into my grandmother's yard, and he got out of the car and was about to say something, and I just told him, grab the old lady. And he got her, brought her over to the car. We got her in the car, and I asked him where the evacuation, where should I go to? There's an evacuation center, and he told me, and took off out of there, and there was nobody on the street anywhere. The first, like, maybe mile of it, things looked normal, and displays were going, and then you went around a curve, and then it was like everything was dark. Everything was, the power was off, and there was no lights, except you went on up a little bit, and you could see right off of the sidewalk whole hill on fire. And everything there was on fire, and the wind was blowing embers into the streets, and the wind was still blowing badly. And I was just, you know, I was concentrating on just, you know, I was looking ahead, keeping that car on the road while also keeping the cat contained. And you could see and feel the heat from this fire just there, and see the embers and little bits of flame just coming right, you know, hitting off the car and on the street. And from out there, pretty much everything was dark or almost dark, which usually at night they're lit up. And went out to the evacuation center, and then, you know, got there. To thank God that we got there, and we were very lucky. We were extremely lucky. It was like hitting the lottery. Neither of our houses aren't my neighbor, who I had talked to, you know, earlier that night, and she had evacuated. Her house also was spared. It stopped right at her driveway.
Tessa and I talked for another 20 minutes. She has such a great recollection of the day. It seemed to be ingrained in her memory. We talked about all the things that went wrong. The natural cause things, like trees and phone lines coming down, transformers and the power going out, but also the human side of things, like muddled evacuation messaging and poor awareness and preparedness for fire evacuation. The most interesting thing about this entire story is that the people on the outside and the people that actually experience the event have the same exact worries and concerns for wildfires.
So that wraps up our look into the Gatlinburg fire from last November. From what I understand, they are still recovering. So if you want to donate to that recovery, we'll post a link in show notes. You can also go to www.knoxvilleweekend.com/how-you-can-help. Do you have any ideas for fun science stories that we could talk about? If so, send us an email at intheelementspod@gmail.com or tweet to us at elementspod.
That's going to do it for this episode of In the Elements. To listen to more episodes, keep listening on iTunes, Stitcher, and your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're listening, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a rating or review, and we'll give you a shout out.
For Dakota, Carrie, Caitlin, and myself, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Yes, science!